This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network with another recording of a local public event. I'm Dan Daniels. On July 31st, 2006, the Thomas Jefferson Area Community Criminal Justice Board and Central Virginia Restorative Justice sponsored the seminar Restorative Practices, Achieving Safe, Healthy, and Respectful Schools. The guest speaker was Mr. Joseph Roy. Mr. Roy is the principal at Springfield Township High School, just outside Philadelphia. Schools are the centers of education, yet all too often violence and disrespect interrupt student learning and teacher instruction. This seminar suggests the development of a restorative, collaborative, constructive, and accountable culture in our schools, without draining resources or compromising instructional time. Mr. Roy highlighted the strategies undertaken in Springfield Township High School, which integrated restorative practices in 2001 and 2002. This is the second of a two-part podcast. In part one, we heard Mr. Roy's comments on restorative practices. In part two, we'll listen to questions from the attendees, followed by Mr. Roy's comments.
Thank you. If you have questions with those cards, at least this is our hope to structure it this way, could you please pass those to the aisle, hold those up. Brian, you could walk down the aisle and pick up some questions or two. Some people had handed some to me ahead of time. One is, you mentioned class meetings or check-ins. Are these that come out specifically around problems, or is it just to see what's going on, and is there not a danger of opening up a can of worms about various problems that kids may have?
Yeah, that's a good question. The circles, they have to become a regular part, even if it's once a week. They have to be a routine that the students are familiar with, so that they're used to discussing things in circles and facing each other and so forth. If you wait until there's a big problem, it won't work. Is there a risk of opening up a can of worms? That is our teacher's biggest concern, is that you say, oh, so what's going on this weekend? And you say, oh, well, you know, you start to hear things you don't want to hear. We tell the teachers, you know, if it's no different than if a student was talking to you one-on-one and starts to tell you some, I don't know, serious suicidal thoughts or some violence at home or in the community, you're gonna say, look, you know, I need to bring you to the guidance or the social worker or whatever, because that's, you know, I want to help you, but that's beyond me, and I'm worried about you. So the teacher, just like they would set limits any time in class, needs to set the limit when it's not an appropriate topic.
Okay, very good. Is this approach being institutionalized by incorporating it into teacher certification curricula?
I guess no. But here's my thing. On teacher training programs, there's a lot of stuff they don't teach teachers that they need when they become teachers. I will say, though, that the International Institute for Restorative Practices, IIRP, which is a group that's based in Bethlehem, that organization just received, after about 5 years of work, approval to be a graduate school. So the IIRP is now a degree-granting institution where you can earn master's degrees in restorative practices and education, restorative practices and counseling. So it's certainly, just as it's grown in this area, it's certainly growing in other areas. It was a huge hurdle to get the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to approve it as a graduate school. So we're excited about that.
There was a question. Are there times when things can't be fixed? What do you do?
Yeah, I've been a principal for a while, and I have my tolerance limit. In fact, sometimes I'll tell kids, you're on my list, and that is not a good thing. And there are certainly times. I mean, kids have lots of issues, and if there are, you know, severe emotional issues or oppositional defiant issues, really what the student needs is a therapeutic situation. There are times, just like I would never claim that this restorative practice or anything else works 100% of the time. That's ridiculous. But so there are certainly kids that we run into that you know, we're not equipped to deal with, basically, at the traditional high school. And we send kids to alternative schools. We don't run an alternative school because we're not that big a district, but there are times. Our strategy, though, is, and I know this is true, there have been times before we were really into restorative practices that we were at the end of the rope with a kid and we're ready to send him to an alternative school. And I knew if we'd have dealt with him differently along the way and he'd had a better connected experience, we wouldn't have been in that position. So what we hope to do is for all those kids who can be in our school, restorative practices makes it much more possible for them to be there and be successful. For the outliers that have such emotional or mental health issues that we're not going to be able to manage them, then no, it's better for the student as well as for the school for them to go elsewhere.
Will restorative practices be a tool for parents who feel that their children have been treated badly in the school by teachers or other personnel?
This has been a great tool with parents because it makes sense to them. We're not just being punitive. We're saying, hey, we want to work with you to help your son or daughter figure out how they're going to, you know, fix this situation or how they're going to avoid future situations. So it comes across as a totally, totally proactive. Even if we suspend the child and the parent is not pleased that we're suspending them, that we try to, in the after follow-up conference, and we focus on how do we fix this, how are we going to, you know, help the student, and how are they going to help themselves be more successful in the future. The parents see that it's more proactive than it was in the past.
Have you seen a corresponding decline in youth violence in the community since you have started teaching skills to deal with conflicts that kids can use elsewhere and into adulthood?
That's a good, very good question. I don't know that I have any data on that. My feeling is no. I don't know that it. I think that we have created a culture in the school where we have very few fights now, and we have a positive culture in the school. But I have concerns about what goes on in the neighborhoods, and I think that doesn't necessarily get translated out into. We have one particular area by the Orland courts, the basketball courts, where issues happen constantly. So I'm not sure. I don't know that there's been a good carryover to community.
Please identify some of the expectations that you would set forth prior to a restorative circle meeting.
Well, one is that everyone's going to have, that we're going to follow, especially the more formal, we're going to follow a process. And for the formal ones, we have a script. We literally just read down the script of what we ask people. But basically the expectations are everyone's going to have their chance. You're talking about how you were affected, not just making an attack on anybody. And you're focusing on yourself, how you were affected. And we're going to listen to everybody and we're going to go in order. By the way, the hardest people that sometimes want to jump right in, I must say, the police officers want to get right to it. And we say, wait, it's not your turn yet. We're going around. They want to get right to it and solve the problem.
How long did it take the practices to take hold? And describe the trainings that you received, and how long did it take to get teachers trained?
In both Palisades and Springfield, where I was principal, it was over a few years. We did exactly what I suggested. We did an overview for everybody, and then we focused on some core groups of people. So, it took 3 or 4 years, probably 4 years, to get really up to speed. And then of course, what we're finding now is with turnover and retirement, you know, you're constantly bringing new people up to speed, on it. So, we're trying to figure out ways to make sure we build in the training is ongoing for people who need it. My experience has been I've learned through, I've gone to trainings run by the IARP people, but my experience has been through working with them. A lot of the work has been kind of mutual in that I'll say, you know, we need to think about this in school, and then they'll work with my teachers to come up with new ideas. The circle training really came from was through our need and our identification of a need. There was something else I was going to say, but I forgot.
How are differences with teachers as teacher circle leadership dealt with. Example, quote, Mr. Jones does not run his circle this way. You aren't running the circle the right way.
Now, that's a question from somebody who knows kids. And I guess, I don't know, my response, I guess, is that that can happen every day to teachers with, you know, this is not how Mr. So-and-so does it. You know, he does it this way. He lets us make up tests. He lets us study before the test, whatever. And the response is, you know, I'm not Mr. Jones. But the challenge is everybody has different personalities. And I know I have some teachers that are not going to be real good at running circles because their real issue is they don't have the best relationship with kids, in circle or outside of circle. That's the biggest challenge in my experience as a principal. It's hard to change. You can't change a person's personality. And so hiring the right people is critical and working the best we can. For teachers who were resistant and did it differently in that they didn't want to do it at all, it's not a choice. If you have great relationships with your kids and you are restorative and the classes are collaborative and running the way we want them to run, great. You know, I don't care how you run your circle, you're achieving the outcome. If you're having discipline problems, and anybody who's an administrator in here can quickly name which teachers you get the most discipline referrals from. It's not a secret. Those are the teachers who are not restorative, and those are often the people who are most resistant to being restorative because it doesn't come naturally to them. So we work with them one-on-one. We view our work with teachers as we need to be restorative. We need to have high expectations for our teachers, and we need to be supportive. And my assistant principals in particular will work with those teachers, but we also have a bottom line, and the bottom line is the teacher is responsible for classroom management. You can't blame the kid or blame the assistant principal. The teacher is responsible. So when you're having a problem, we will help you, but we're going to help you through restorative practices. If you reject restorative practices and continue to have problems, then that's an issue. That's an evaluation issue. And so we don't really run into a lot of resistance anymore. The dinosaurs are pretty much gone.
When do you think police should get involved?
I pretty much believe that if you commit a crime in school, that the police should be involved. There are sometimes as I mentioned with a young student, new student, we didn't do that with the graffiti, but for the most part, if there's a fight, if there's vandalism, if there's graffiti, even disorderly conduct, which I love because my reading of that can almost apply to anything, anytime. If a student is really disruptive and out of control, we will absolutely call the police. Springfield Township is not a large community. Our police department's right across the street. They're awesome. They're awesome with the kids. They work with us extremely closely. My approach is if you break the law, we call the police.
Do you find that a few students will say what you want to hear, then go ahead and do what they want to anyway? And what do you do then?
Yeah, no, that never happens. Again, nothing's a magic bullet. So if it doesn't work, just like anything else, if it doesn't work the first time, as far as saying what we want to hear, well, part of it is I do want them to at least say it. And I had a thing at the end of the school year with a student who I think I had a guest with me, and he's coming out of the cafeteria, and he's like in ninth grade, and he's shoving somebody, you know, doing a ninth grade thing. And I kind of give him a look, especially because I'm standing here with a guest. He looks at me and then does it again. So I went and grabbed him, stopped him with his backpack, and immediately was like, well, what do I want to hear you say? Don't push in the hallway, be respectful, blah, blah, blah. Thank you, go. And that's all I wanted to do. So, you know, you want to at least have them say it. How deeply they mean it is another thing. But if the student ultimately it's their behavior. So if they say it and they don't really mean it, and then they do something else, you're going to be dealing with them again, and you're going to go through it again.
Where was the question? Oh, yes. Do adults acknowledge their mistakes or limitations or problems in the system, apologize, and fix things from their end?
That's a great. That is great. Because to really work, right, everyone's got to be real and honest in it. And that can be, Let's put it this way. It works best if the teacher can go in and say, you know, I was having a bad day. I know I was short from my, I was upset about my previous class, and when you said that, I just, you know, I jumped on you, so I apologize for that. But then you get back to what it is the student did and what they're going to do it. So it absolutely works best when everybody can be honest. And in fact, I was sharing with someone, I think, before the program that, you know, you can not be restorative. You can have a non-restorative moment because you're just ticked off. And it doesn't mean you can't recover and the next day have a restorative conversation with the student. I mean, in fact, with my assistant principal, sometimes, you know, I might say, you know what, I am not in a restorative mood. You better deal with this one. And sometimes it's okay. I mean, depending on how, you know, if we have a serious fight or an assault, I'm angry that it's happened. They're going to be arrested. They're going to be suspended, and they're going to be sent out. That's not the time in the heat of the moment to have a restorative conversation. You separate them. They have to be removed from the community, and then when they come back, you start to figure out how they're going to come back and start to make up for it. So, anyway.
That leads me to a question. Are there particular approaches that are taken when a student does return to school?
Well, what we always try to do, and this is we always, even if they get kicked out of class, we want this to happen, that there's some dialogue before they return with the assistant principal, counselor, and ideally with the teacher. And sometimes schedules, that's hard to do with the teacher. But yeah, the key part, if they're out of school, is you have to have, and most schools have post-suspension conferences. So it's not even new time on that. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not more time. It's just using the time a little differently to focus on making sure the student knows who was affected and how they're going to start to make up for it.
I'm going to combine two. One is, does this training of circles in any way involve parents down the road? And then does restorative practices ever involve the parents in any of the restorative conversations? If so, how? If not, why not?
As far as the training, we've done some things through our PTA. In fact, I was thinking about this as I was thinking about this presentation. It's probably been a few years. We probably need to go back and re-educate because we probably have parents of 9th and 10th graders that weren't around when we did a big push for parents a couple of years ago on restorative practices. So we probably need to come back and do more. I think keeping parents informed is critical. Involving parents in the conferences, absolutely. Especially if anytime there's a suspension, they're going to be involved, or if there's just an ongoing issue with the teacher. And we make our judgments. Some parents, you know, wouldn't be particularly helpful in a conference, so we wouldn't have them. And most of those who would be, and we involve them, and they play the same role, though. They are in the conference talking about how they're affected by what's going on. That totally changes the dynamic of a parent trying to just defend their child. What we want to hear from you is, how are you affected? Oh, I'm out of work. I had to come into school again. And it changes the dynamic completely on the parent.
How has this new focus on relationships affected academic results, standardized test scores, achievement gap problems, and dropout rates?
We're a pretty high-performing school overall, although I just got the state results before I came down here, and they dipped a little bit this year. But it's hard to draw the connect. It's hard to make a statistical connection between, you know, relationships and better student behavior and performance, other than, you know, we know that it certainly increases time on task in classrooms and so forth. So our school does well. I believe our biggest challenge is to continue to do the focus on the relationship building as our community continues to change so that we maintain a high level of performance. Because there are a lot of private schools in our area, and one-third of the students, school-age students in Springfield Township, go to private schools. And that's not uncommon for districts in our area because there are so many private schools. And our fear, our concern always is we need to focus on performance, because if the high school's performance starts to dip, more people are going to send their kids to private schools. So it's hard to make that connection. What we do know is we've had a significant decrease in discipline. I wanted to mention this as a warning. Our discipline decreased to the point that the assistant, I have two assistant principals, the superintendent found it appropriate to make one of my assistant principals also be the athletic director. So that was like a good and a bad thing, because it's hard to do those two jobs, but it's manageable because of where the discipline is now.
Restorative practices address behaviors. While school counselors should not be disciplinarians, they are trained to address the social and emotional and cognitive aspects underlying a behavior. How have you utilized your school's mental health professionals regarding restorative practice and school culture?
Yeah, and again, I'm sure everyone who's an administrator knows that we want to keep, and it's very important to counselors, to keep a line that they don't want to be perceived as disciplinarians or that they're imposing any consequences. And I think that's easy because the restorative questions, a guidance counselor can ask those questions. What happened? How were you affected? How were others affected? What do you think you can do to, you know, solve this problem in the classroom so you're not having this? So I think the restorative questions in a conversation between a counselor and a student are absolutely completely appropriate for counselors.
Do you have any activities besides circles in your schools to increase cross-cultural understanding? And if so, what kind of activities?
We have a group called STOP, Students Together Opposing Prejudice, that organizes some educational days and activities. We do a diversity day where we bring in all kinds of performers and foods and from a wide variety of cultural backgrounds to raise awareness in that area.
What about confidentiality when involving role models in formal meetings?
Yeah, that's a question we've chosen to ignore. Because that you could, I mean, you know, and it could depend on how, you know, in my view, uptight upper level people in the district might be, because yeah, you could argue the example I gave where we got two older kids to come in that was breaking confidentiality, that the student was involved because they weren't directly a victim. There's not a confidentiality issue if, you know, somebody punches somebody, so you have the victim and the puncher there because everybody knows. So that's just one we've chosen to not worry about.
How many people or who are specifically trained in restorative practices in your school, and how many and who would you recommend be trained in a school?
Well, all of our teachers have been trained at this point, and we have sent, a couple of our counselors and our social worker there's a training on how to run a formal conferencing, so that when we have an incident, we have someone that can really, when we run a formal conference, we have someone who's trained to go through the formal procedure. But other than that, everyone's been trained, and I would say that my assistant principals now, after 5 or 6 years, are very well-versed in working with teachers as new teachers come on who have less experience doing it.
What is the poverty level like in your school district?
Springfield is a middle class to upper middle class, I would say, school district. It's a range. It covers only 7 square miles, but then you range from places that I would describe as mansions, although most of those kids go to private schools, to lower level housing and apartment housing. But overall, I would say middle to upper middle class. So our poverty levels are relatively low.
For elementary schools, are there any modifications that you would suggest for implementation and at the primary elementary level?
Yeah, and I've been to presentations where elementary teachers have talked about how they've used restorative practices, and obviously they have much more knowledge and experience than I do with that. But I think that, you know, and again, I don't have an elementary background. Modifications would have to be made, I would assume, for students, you know, what their level of understanding is and how they can you know, what's the best way to have kids have conversations. But the classroom circle idea that's pretty common in elementary schools is very close to the class meeting idea. So I'm not sure. I don't know enough to know what, you know, how exactly you'd have to tinker with things for the elementary.
How much money did implementation take, and how much on a continuing basis?
It costs about $1,500, at least this is working with the IARP group out of Bethlehem, $1,500 for a trainer for a day. And if you go over, I mean, they do that for maybe up to 30 or 40 people. And if you're going to have more than that, then they'd want to have another trainer so they could break it up. So it's not outrageously expensive. We're also at the point now that a lot of the, like all the initial training for new teachers, we do ourselves because we have enough people with experience that they can do it. When we're doing kind of a more in-depth circle training that we did in June and we'll do in August, we're working with the IARP people.
What role does empathy, understanding the other, not sympathy, play in restorative practices, both for the victim and the perpetrator? I worry that without empathy, share and blame will remain.
Meaning that the victim has some piece of the blame?
Shame and blame, excuse me.
Yeah, I think empathy, well, I think a large part of this is about empathy and getting the offender to realize that he affected other people and then hopefully have some empathy about that. But I think we're more likely to have empathy by having them realize they affected people than by not even going there and just using a punitive approach. I also think that, and I don't know, you know, my background's not in the justice system, but I also think that that shame can be okay. If you do something wrong and you feel shame about it, that's okay. I don't think it should be just left there. You should have some, and I think that's where what are you going to do to fix it? There's something you need to act proactively to make up for it. But I think shame, if you've done something that invokes shame, is okay. Personal opinion.
How does your in-school suspension room work?
Some days better than others. The way it's supposed to work is that we may assign a student to in-school suspension rather than out-of-school suspension, so it could just be a consequence that they're getting as part of whatever's going on. It can also be used in a limited way by if a teacher, something happens and a teacher just has to exclude the student from class, kick them out. But then they come down. We have a paraprofessional who runs the room and who will then give them a sheet with the restorative questions on it. They have to, and sometimes, you know, she'll wait till people calm down or whatever, and then they'll fill out the restorative questions. She reads it. Like I mentioned, if they're inappropriate, like fire the teacher as the answer, we say, try again, until they come up with something. Again, we're not questioning how sincere they are about it. We just want them to say the words and write it down and what they're going to do to try to accept responsibility and fix it. Then they will see the assistant principal and hopefully the teacher before they return to class the next day, assuming it's the next day. And that's where sometimes it's tough just timing, you know, when it happens, when the teacher's available, when you can get the student and so forth. But we, particularly if it's anything of any real significance, we make sure, even if it means the kid misses 2 days of class, if it's significant enough, we have to have the conversation between the student and the teacher before they go back into class. We make sure that happens.
By high school, some of the teachers of top-level students use practices that fit in your top left corner, punitive. My concern is that sometimes the school doesn't always care about the affective realm for high achievers.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I worry about that sometimes with that we put, and what I'm thinking that question is getting at is high achievers often there's a lot of pressure on them. If they're in the honors and the advanced placement classes and they're doing activities and sports, they put in unbelievably long days and take very challenging courses. And I think that sometimes, I know I've absolutely had this conversation. We don't have an answer, but we've had the conversation with my assistant principal about sometimes our teachers of the high-end students, the honor students, as we call them, think that they should be fully, that honor students should be fully formed human beings and they should be perfect in every way and forget that they're still 15 years old or they're 16 years old and they're going to screw up every now and then. And not every kid who's really bright is going to be, you know, the teacher's pet who asks for extra credit and is there every day with his pencil sharpened. And so I think that's an interesting point, and one that we've worried about is trying to work with certain teachers to say, yeah, they're honored. That means they're bright and motivated, we hope, but it doesn't mean that, you know, they don't need help and support.
I see we're pretty much out of time. I'll ask two more questions that don't seem to quite have been asked. What is the range of typical number of hours that are spent in this? And then at the same time, from what I've heard you say, it's sort of a kind of a continuous ongoing way of interaction. Is there any quantitative way to place that if one was to make this move?
Yeah, I don't know how to do that, because from a teacher's perspective, you're already dealing with kids, you're dealing with issues in class. This is a shift in how you might approach it. Assistant principals, you're already dealing with discipline referrals and so forth. So it's a shift in how you deal with it. So our teachers will tell you, and my wife, who is a teacher in another school, will tell you that the time up front, building the relationship and using circles, is more than. And my wife teaches in her school, teaches a lot of the kids that nobody else wants to teach. I forgot to say it. I'm glad you asked that question because she told me to say it today. That the time up front is really, you know, comes back later when you have less issues.
And then our last question will be, can you just give some examples of follow-through on a conference and the monitoring of that follow-through?
Yeah, we had a formal conference where we renovated our building a couple years ago. And the swim team, I didn't know this, but the swim team had a little, I knew that they had a little locker room inside the locker room just for the boys swimmers. And in the lockers in there, that were 50 years old before the renovations, apparently each year you'd get your locker and then you would scratch in your name. So there's like a long list of names. And so now we have new lockers, and the swimmers, you know, kept their tradition with the new lockers. And I flipped out because it's brand new. It was one of the first areas of the building open, and now they've, you know, scratched their names on the inside of the new lockers. So we did a formal conference. And the follow-through, some of the outcomes were they proposed and they did write letters to everybody who was involved, who apologized. They were suspended from the team for 2 weeks, so their teammates were affected, their coach was affected. They basically had to forfeit. They didn't have a chance of winning the meets they had when they were out. It wasn't everybody on the team. So they wrote letters of apology to a number of people. My assistant principal followed up to make sure that those letters took place. They also had to pay for the damage that they did, again, my assistant principal had to follow through to make sure that the payments happened.
All join me, please, in thanking Mr. Roy for his time.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.